ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 12, The War Machines. As ever, I have my trusty podcast partner, who I'm happy to say is not my partner in real life, Martin.
Thank God for that. How are you then, Jim?
I'm not bad, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm okay. I hear congratulations are in order.
They are, thank you very much. Yes, there has been the rustle and slither of a tiny crinoid in our family.
The pod has opened, has it?
Yes. And a little wien is walking about. Oh. Well, not walking yet, obviously, but vomiting and filling nappies and things like that.
Nice.
Much like its father.
Yeah. You still haven't grown out of that, have you?
No. It's a tough habit to break.
Anyway, moving on.
Yes, enough of that. Before we get started on War Machines, a little step backwards to our previous podcast, number 11, Spearhead from Space. We missed a couple of little bits of feedback from last time that came in after we recorded. Mike Doyle, a regular contributor, has some highlights of Spearhead from Space. In particular, John Pertwee's eyebrow work, which was rather impressive. A wheelchair chase that seems to be out of a Norman Wisdom film. That's true. Perhaps the accompanying soundtrack helps with that as well, doesn't it? He also asked, why couldn't we have had a doctor in a flat cap? Which is a good point, because that's what he tries on, isn't it, before he goes for the big floppy hat. He's interested in the unit soldiers who will both shoot at anything and are happy to moonlight as car park attendants. And he remarks about the good, healthy 70s sexism, which, is prevalent throughout.
Definitely. Yeah, and we got some feedback from Wayne Peters as well, another regular contributor. Amongst other things, he comments on the Doctor's tattoo. And he says, I had this idea for a while that maybe there was a feudal caste system on Gallifrey. Time Lords and Peasants. And the Lords used the peasants' bodies in their regenerations. This gave a rather dark side of regeneration and would, I think, be something the Doctor would be dead against, so maybe not. And why would a Gallifreyan peasant have an anchor tattooed on his arm anyway? Well, I don't think it was an anchor, but interesting idea.
Yeah, it's a serpent, I think, isn't it, some sort? Good idea, though. I like it.
Mm.
That we know they've got a dark past, don't we, from the Death Zone and all the rest of it, so...
A dark future as well.
Of course, yes. Mm. Involving a spitting Timothy Dalton.
Indeed.
It doesn't get darker than that.
No. Okay, so shall we crack on with the War Machines then?
Let's do this.
Well, I chose it, so I'll do the context for this one. We're looking at, obviously, William Hartnell, and it's his third season, the final story of the third season. It's actually the third to last William Hartnell's story, actually, so it's near the end of his run. It was broadcast in June and July 1966, written by Ian Stuart Black from an idea by Kit Pedler. The producer at the time was Ennis Lloyd, and the script editor, Jerry Davis. Notable for several things, really, the departure of Dodo, much-loved Dodo, leaves in this story. And the arrival of two new companions, Ben and Polly, who will oversee the regeneration of Hartnell into Troughton. And it's also the first story set entirely in contemporary Earth, or contemporary London, in fact. So interesting for that. And the location shooting that is in the story as well. So that's what we're looking at this month.
Yeah, it's the also in terms of the terrible destruction of the BBC archives, this is the last complete William Hartnell story, isn't it? The Smugglers in the Tenth Planet are the last two of his reign, and neither of those are complete. So this is only complete by the skin of its teeth, isn't it? There's lots of patching together of audio and little bits of film here and there found in Australia and all sorts to put this together for the DVD.
Yeah, exactly. They've done a really good job with it, haven't they?
Mm, yeah, definitely. Okay, so episode one begins with some rather exciting special futuristic lettering and computer noises which spell out the story name and the writer is Stuart Black, and the episode number. Which, they do this sort of thing occasionally, don't they?
Yeah, they've done it a couple of times.
This is one of the earliest examples, if not the earliest. Yeah, it gives it an extra little bit of something, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes it kind of stand out. Yeah, interesting. It's nice. Yeah, it's nice to see something different, really.
Yeah, it is. But that goes straight into quite an impressive shot, I think. It's there's a high zoom. The camera's actually at the top of the Centrepoint building. The idea is that it's this shot is taken from the post office tower, which features very strongly in the story. But because it had only recently opened to the public, the BBC weren't actually allowed to film there, so they actually do this camera shot from the top of the Centrepoint building, which is close by. And it's a great kind of zoom, isn't it, down into Bedford Square. It's a sort of an early prototype of the kind of Peter Jackson camera swoops that we saw in the Lord of the Rings films.
Do you think it was influenced by the war machines then?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. Anyway, the camera swoops down to Bedford Square in the Bloomsbury area of London. And we see the TARDIS appearing on the pavement there.
Mm. And out step the Doctor and Dodo.
Yeah, the dream team.
Yeah.
Hartnell and Dodo.
Yeah. The Doctor puts an out of order sign on the TARDIS. Interestingly, the first shot is silent, isn't it? You know, because it's shot on film. And then it switches to the studio and they speak to each other.
Yeah, it's all a little bit Marcel, isn't it? Beginning. A little bit of mime.
Yeah. But a policeman walks towards the TARDIS, and the Doctor explains to Dodo that, you know, she asks why, as he put the sign on there. He says, sometimes the TARDIS can be mistaken for the real thing.
There's an awful false laugh, isn't there, from Jackie Lane playing Dodo when she imagines what would happen if a policeman actually did manage to get into the TARDIS and was swept away into time and space. Rather unconvincing laugh afterwards.
Yeah. Then we get the first of many cock-ups from the Doctor.
Oh.
Where he says something's up, he can scent it. And Dodo, to her credit, or Jackie Lane to her credit, says very naturally, oh, it smells okay to me. Good old London smoke.
Yeah, that's she does well, Ed.
Yeah.
Well, she's done a few stories with Hartnell by now, and she realises she has to be something of a safety net, like everyone else who works.
Yeah.
But clearly he was trying to say sense it, and it doesn't quite make it.
Yeah.
But interestingly, on that point, he says he feels a kind of prickling sensation on his skin that he's got previously when meeting the Daleks. That, I think, is the first we've heard of that. But and it's not really elaborated on, is it, why, well, it turns out the supercomputer and its war machines should have that effect on the Doctor like the Daleks do. But it's a kind of a intriguing but a little bit throwaway.
Yeah, and he fluffs that as well.
He does, yeah.
So he's said two lines so far and fluffed them both.
An auspicious beginning.
But they look up and they see the post office tower, don't they? And he says that it seems to be coming from there, whatever he's feeling. So they sort of head off towards it.
Or smelling,
yeah. And then you see them kind of walking through the streets. And again, it's filmed, so you don't hear them saying anything. But it's nice. I like it. You know, it looks good, I think.
I like all the location work in this. I think it works really well, and it is quite different to see, firstly, that amount of location work, and, of course, it being in contemporary London.
Yeah, so the next scene we see is inside the tower, and the Doctor and Dodo are being shown in to meet a Professor Brett in a kind of a computer room at the top of the tower, and he's with his secretary there, who he turns out, as we will find out in a little while, is Polly. Yeah, I was a bit surprised that suddenly they were there, and, you know, they seemed to know who the Doctor was, or, you know, I'm not sure how he managed to convince, I think he's Major Green says he's a computer specialist. He's shown him by Major Green, isn't he?
Yeah, it could have done with a line of an explanation here, couldn't it? The novelisation, target novelisation by Ian Stuart Black is actually written from the camera script, I think, rather than what was seen on screen. And apparently at some point there was going to be a mention of Ian Chesterton.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, apparently Ian has got into some sort of position of authority in the scientific community, and the Doctor and Dodo got in on the strength of that. But obviously, by the time it reaches his recording and transmission, that is completely gone. So it is a little bit surprised when it just wafts into the top of the post office tower, which we later find out is a very secure area.
Mm. But interestingly, this kind of happens throughout the story, doesn't it? That the Doctor seems to be quite well connected, doesn't he?
Mm.
And seems to be able to come and go as he pleases, and people kind of almost revere him, don't they?
Yeah, that's true, and again, perhaps under-explained on each of those occasions as well.
Yeah, but I kind of think it's a sign of things to come, that it's one of the early examples of where the Doctor can, his influence is already there, and people kind of look to him.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, yeah.
God knows why, because he's an old duffer.
Yeah, I mean, he appears to you or I to be a bumbling fool, but perhaps they can see something else in him.
Anyway, Brett explains about Wotan, which is this sort of supercomputer.
Yes, that's right. And the cast will pronounce it as Wotan, although it obviously stands for Will Operated Thought Analog. Wotan was a Germanic name for the Anglo-Saxon god. It's kind of tying those two things in together, and it's called Wotan throughout, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Whether or not we'll manage to call it Wotan or Wotan is another matter.
No, I think we'd probably interchange it, depending on, you know, whether we remember.
Yeah, it's the same computer, there aren't two of them. Professor Brett explains that Wotan is the most advanced computer ever made, and it was soon going to be linked to other computers around the world to create a central intelligence, or, as we know it today, the International Cobweb.
Yeah.
The Internet itself.
Inventing the Internet 30 years early.
Yeah, a nice bit of a pressing piece of writing there.
Anyway, according to Brett, Vote can think faster and type faster than Polly.
That's incredible.
It is incredible, because I've seen her type, and she can go, I tell you.
she really motors.
And, it's also a thinking machine, at which point the Doctor gets very interested. He does his customary, and then he goes over to the machine to test it out, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's a bit sceptical that a machine can be devised and can think for itself. And as Professor Brett claims, never makes mistakes. So that immediately piques the Doctor's interest. So he tries to challenge Wotan to give him the square root of a very large number, which it almost gets right, although it gets to five or six decimal places, and it either fails to round up or rounds up and in the wrong place and gets it slightly wrong. And to the Doctor's credit, he says, well, that's near enough.
Yeah, as if he could work that out in his head. But next, Dodo asks, what does TARDIS mean? And Wotan whirs away, and out comes a printout saying time and relative dimensions in space. So it gets it right, much to the Doctor's consternation.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. It's not elaborated on, is it, in the story? But at this point in the show's history, we are led to believe that TARDIS is a name made up by Doctor's granddaughter, Susan, rather than a word that in everyday use.
Yeah, I mean, at this point in the show's history, they haven't been back to, contemporary times. But, you know, if you're looking at the show as a whole, then certainly, you know, Sylvester McCoy goes back to 1963. Many of the other Doctors have gone back to that kind of time. In fact, when Ben and Polly leave their final story, The Faceless Ones, they return to the day that they left, which is the same day as this story's set. So, it can be explained, but you have to kind of look at it with hindsight.
Yeah, and at this point, when Dodo's questioning Wotan, she complains about a slight buzzing in her ears, which becomes quite significant later on in the story.
Mm. Hartnell, meanwhile, is very interested in Wotan. He's asking Brett about what various bits of it do, and he refers to the program Regimentator or something. which I'm sure he just made up on the spot because he couldn't remember what you're supposed to say.
Yes, it may be scripted, but it certainly doesn't sound it.
Funnily enough, he then goes on to start saying something else, but Brett just sort of walks off to check on Toto and leaves him kind of hanging, doesn't he? Arnold kind of looks around a bit bewildered and then he just sort of hunches over and just pretends he's examining something.
Yeah, if you want to see Hartnell at his best, then this is not a good era of his reign, really, because for the poor fellow, he's quite ill at this stage, and his memory of lines is not at all good.
No.
And it does cause problems throughout this story, unfortunately.
I think he has good days and bad days, though, because some of the stories in this season of Doctor Who, he's actually quite good in it. But this one, you know, throughout, is kind of all over the place. It's a shame.
Yeah, it is. But there are moments where he's quite authoritative, aren't there, in this story. But there are a lot of fluffs as well, unfortunately.
So Polly's a bit concerned about Dodo, and she sort of asks her if she wants to go and lie down or something. But Dodo says, oh, no, you know, I'd much rather go to the hottest night spot in town. To which Polly replies, well, that's easy. That's the Inferno.
Yes, and then we cut to the hottest night spot in town, which is... has the whiff of a youth club about it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does a bit.
But there's some quite groovy 60s music going on.
Mm. So Polly and Dodo arrive, and they come into the club, and they meet Kitty, who is obviously a friend of Polly's, who's working sort of behind the bar. And she complains about a sailor who's been coming in and just sort of sitting at the end of the bar, looking glum. And sure enough, he turns up. And it's able seaman Ben Jackson, who comes in, sits at the end of the bar, and looks glum.
Yeah, as predicted.
So Kitty wants Polly to go and cheer Ben up, which he agrees to go and try. And she goes over to him and, you know, asks him what's up. He says that his ship's gone to the West Indies, but he's been left behind on a shore posting. He's going to be in barracks for 6 months, which is why he's really upset. Polly quite quickly gets fed up with him and leaves him to his mood, and is then accosted by a smarmy kind of wide boy bloke, isn't she?
Yeah, it was quite obvious what he's after, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, I'll show you a good time sort of thing in you know, in a fairly obvious way. Ben actually eventually jumps to her defence, but only really after he's been called half pint and shorty by this bloke. So his motivation is completely clear when he has a go at this fella. But he basically starts and pretty quickly ends a bit of a bar brawl with this bloke. And I think it comes over pretty well on the screen.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's quite convincing. Anyway, Kitty comes over and Ben says, oh, you know, he's just leaving. And this bloke scuttles off with his tail between his legs. And Ben sort of has a go at Polly for encouraging him.
Yeah, it doesn't go down very well, does it?
Not really, but Dodo sort of steps in and says, you know, sort of thanks him for getting him out of the corner.
Mm. At this point, we switch to some location footage where the Doctor's taken a taxi to the Royal Scientific Club for a press conference about Votan. So Charles Summer is on the stage. He's the head of the Royal Scientific Club, and he announces that on the following Monday, July 16th, all other computers around the world will come under the control of Votan in an event that he's calling C-Day or Computer Day. Mm. And behind him there's a board showing, you know, these sort of key computers that are going to be linked up to Votan. They include the computers for the Parliament, White House and Telstar, which was quite exciting in those days.
Yeah, and there's, you know, quite a big crowd of reporters there, isn't there? And there's a fellow from the New York sketch who is asking about, you know, where the power's going to lie, who's going to operate Votan when it's all linked up. And Sir Charles replies that, you know, no one's going to do it. Votan is going to operate itself. It's reliant on pure thought. But the press people, they're not convinced that Votan is able to think for itself. And they kind of ask, what if it decides it can do without people? Which is basically the premise of this whole story. So they identify that quite early on.
Mm, and so does the Doctor, really, because he looks quite uneasy when all this stuff is being said. So Charles is saying that Votan has no political allegiances or any reason to lie or hide the truth.
Mm.
and all this stuff sounds to our ears as modern viewers looks very, very suspect.
Yeah, it does. Anyway, they're expecting Professor Brett, but he's late. He's obviously working late in the tower. They're wondering where he is, and it cuts to the tower where Brett is about to leave. Major Green comes in. Brett complains about a feeling of someone else being in the building, listening. He's looking around behind him and talks to the Major about it, but you know, the Major says, well, there's only us here. And he leaves the room. And Brett's about to follow him, but he keeps kind of stopping and looking behind him. You know, he's obviously spooked by something. And then finally, Voten obviously makes its move, because you hear this sound that you hear.
Yeah, it's a sort of an electronic sort of tune, I suppose, isn't it?
Hmm. Which you hear whenever Voten's trying to control something. And you get these kind of concentric circles overlaid on the camera, don't you?
Mm.
And Brett starts to hold his head, and he's sort of saying, oh, this is ridiculous, I must be imagining things. And he puts his fists up to his head, and, you know, as if there's something going on inside his brain sort of thing, and then he drops into his side, he turns around to Voten and says, what do you want? Mm. Quite an interesting scene, really. I'm not entirely convinced by the acting in it, but yeah, I like the idea.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's it feels a little bit of a tired idea now, doesn't it, that a computer will start thinking of itself and start taking over for humans. But it's the first time it appears in Doctor Who.
Mm.
So looking back to an audience in 1966 is, you know, might be considered quite a scary concept, because obviously computers were becoming more and more sort of prevalent, weren't they, at that time?
Mm, that's right.
But we go back to the Inferno Club. Dodo tells Polly and a much happier, or a much more alcoholically refreshed Ben, that she has a bit of a headache. So when Polly and Ben go back for another dance, she doesn't join them.
Yeah, so Charles is apologising for Brett just as he arrives, basically. He comes in and he kind of barges straight through the crowd and asks to see Professor Crimpton. He ignores all the press, goes straight up to Crimpton and takes him out of the room with him, doesn't he? Basically ignoring all the attempts to question him. Hartnell and Charles are quite surprised by this, and they're sort of discussing things, and so Charles thinks something may have actually gone wrong with Voten, which is why Brett is acting how he is. And he mentions that Crimpton's an electronics expert. And the Doctor goes, I wonder. Yes. In the usual Hartnell manner.
Yes, more ums than are strictly necessary. Back in the Voten room, Major Green is doing his kind of security rounds, I guess, and he quite quickly comes under Votan's control, doesn't he, when he wanders into the room. The same sort of fists to the temples and the music and the circles and all the rest we just described. He then seems to receive almost telepathic instructions, doesn't he, because at this point we don't hear Voten speak. And then he goes over to the phone and calls the Inferno Club asking for Dodo.
That's right. Kitty answers and then goes to get Dodo and passes the phone. Meanwhile, Green is patching in Voten directly to the phone line. And at the other end of the phone, Dodo, who is obviously under the influence of Voten, says, yes, I understand. She just gets up and leaves the club without mentioning it to anybody.
Yeah, by this stage, Professor Brett has returned to Voten with Professor Crimpton, who is basically manhandling, isn't he,
yeah.
into the office. And Crimpton's having none of it, really. Brett's explaining to him that Voten has come to the conclusion that humans can't develop the world any further. And Voten will have to take control, and humans will be Votan's servants. Of course, the alarm bells are ringing for Crimpton at this point, and he attempts to leave, but Major Green steps in, and after a valiant effort, much more of an effort to resist Voten's will than the other two have shown, or Dodo come to that, Crimpton eventually falls under his control.
Yeah, some quite interesting lines he comes out with while they're attempting to convert him. Machines cannot govern man, all this kind of stuff. It's quite
I like Crimpton, actually. There's something about him that he's very watchful, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I do like him. I've got a bit of an issue with Brett, He's really strange. When he walks in, he kind of does all these kind of flourishes and, you know, spinning on his heel and stuff, doesn't he? He has to get in the exactly right spot to, and then he delivers his lines. And there's quite a lot of the scenes but with him and Crimpton where they're basically discussing Votan's plans, clearly just for the audience.
Yeah, but it's interesting. You'll see them both kind of line up facing the camera, won't you?
Yeah.
Slightly behind and slightly to the left sort of thing, so they're both pointing towards the camera with Votan behind. Mm. And it feels a little bit over-stylized for the rest of the tone of the program, doesn't it? But I quite enjoyed it.
Back at the Inferno Club, Polly and Ben have realised that Dodo disappeared and they're worried about it. The Doctor arrives and Kitty sort of sees him come in. She makes a reference to him looking like that disc jockey, which is clearly meant to be Jimmy Savile, isn't it?
Yes, the famous disc jockey from the 1960s and later. Don't worry, in a minute I'll do an impression of Jimmy Savile.
I didn't think you could do one. So the Doctor sort of comes down into the club and walks over to them. And they, sort of greets them. And Kitty says, it's not often we get the over 20s in here. And she says, I dig your fab gear.
Yeah, brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Swinging 60s right there.
Exactly. It's quite amusing. Polly introduces Ben to the Doctor. And they tell him that Dodo's disappeared.
At this point, Professor Brett announces that there's another human brain that Votan needs to serve him, quite a rather special brain. Dodo, at this point, arrives in Professor Brett's office and is instructed by Votan, who comes out with this rather halting delivery, with a bit of a strange mumble before.
Yeah.
He ends up saying, Doctor Who is required. Bring him here.
But not in that voice.
Oh, no, the voice is completely different to that, but those are the words that he used.
And, I'm not going to argue with that. Those were the words.
Those were the words. Which is quite odd, because, he doesn't speak a lot, Votan, but you'd think a computer of this level of advancement would, if it did use human English speech, would deliver it rather better than that.
Mm. But more importantly... Doctor Who?
Yeah, what's he talking about?
Yeah, interestingly, it's the only time in the show's history where somebody refers to the Doctor as Doctor Who.
Mm.
And they do it throughout the story, don't they?
Yeah, it crops up for years and years in the actual credits at the end of the episodes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But, it's never said other than this episode. It's the odd little kind of joke. The character's never described as that, which is, it really jumps out at you, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It's very out of place.
Yeah, it's what people call the Doctor who don't really watch Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yeah. It's the first thing I think, whenever I think of the War Machines, I always think of that, because it's kind of really striking for the wrong reason, really.
Yeah, and perhaps the most significant moment in the War Machines, really.
Well, biggest
talking point. But an interesting, the episode end, there's a W, isn't there, superimposed on the screen, which is a W that you see on, the various bits of the Votan machinery, which is a nice kind of stylistic ending for the episode, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, so you got the stylistic titles at the start and the end. Yeah, it's good stuff. So anyway, that's the end of the episode, and, the following week we get the recap. Dodo leaves the room, and then you get the title, the computerized title. So obviously you get the music at the start. You get a little scene with the recap, Dodo leaves, and then you get these War Machines titles. This time it's black writing on white background, because that keeps changing each week, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's different in episode 3, isn't it?
Yeah, but one week it comes up almost like a typewriter or a vidi printer type titles, and sometimes it just comes up with a title, straight away. Sometimes it's black on white, sometimes it's white on black, and then one week it flashes between the two, doesn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, Brett gives orders to Crimpton and Major Green, and he says that Votan will decide on the future of the human race in the next few days. Crimson tears a readout from Votan, and he says that London's going to be the first city to be taken over, then Washington and Moscow. War machines must be built. We require skilled labour. There will be contact by telephone. We will put them through to thwart control. It's just like basically just listing things. And again, this is a readout from Votan that he's teared off. Sometimes Brett seems to get his instructions directly into his head, doesn't he?
Mm.
Without having to hear anything.
And others do.
Yeah, Major Green does as well, doesn't he? But it's the first sort of bit where we get them basically just telling us the plot.
Mm-hmm. Green is given the task of determining which locations these machines are going to be constructed in.
Mm.
And Brett's going to oversee the constructions, and Climpton is going to prepare their programming. But before that, he's given a higher priority, and that is to bring them Doctor Who tonight.
Yeah, the Doctor's still at the Inferno with Polly and Ben. Polly wants to go to the police, but the others aren't convinced. And then she decides she's going to call the hospitals to see if Dodo's turned up one of those. And then suddenly Dodo arrives, just comes in out of the blue. She says that she was called by some old friends, she went to see them. The Doctor kind of reprimands her for not telling them about it. But that's about it. Nobody really sort of makes it too much of a fuss about it, do they?
Yeah, Dodo's behaviour is a lot more natural than other people who've been controlled by Votan, isn't it?
Yeah.
At this stage. I mean, later on she gets, a bit more zombie-like, but everyone else is pretty zombie at this stage.
Mm.
I don't know if that's something that is Michael Ferguson, the director, wanted her to do, or whether that's a failing of Jackie Lane, but it does stand out a little bit, because you know she's under control, but she doesn't really display much, many of those symptoms that all the others do.
No, but she's been given a task to try and, bring the Doctor back. The others don't need to pretend that they're not controlled, do they? Whereas she does.
Well, maybe that's Votan being clever then.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. The Doctor tells her they've been invited to Sir Charles Summers' house. Is it for dinner or...?
Well, this is a mistake, I think, by Hartnell, because I believe what he's supposed to say is that Sir Charles has invited them to stay the night. But he actually says he's asked them to pay him and his family a visit. So it seems rather odd in the following morning when he's still there, doesn't it?
It does. Plus, his family aren't there. They're in the country, aren't they?
Yeah.
As we find out a bit later.
That's another inconsistency.
Anyway, they all leave the Inferno and they go out to the street. Ben and Polly go off to find a taxi. And Dodo basically tries to kidnap the Doctor. You see... In the background, there's some very dodgy-looking men. One of them's got, a bottle of chloroform, isn't he, in his hand. And they're hiding sort of in an alleyway nearby. And Dodo's trying to take the Doctor over towards them. She says, there's loads of taxis over this way.
Yeah, I think that's quite a good, slightly unnerving scene, isn't it? Because, it gives the impression that, Votan is really recruiting quite heavily now.
Mm.
Because there are these people we haven't seen before who are clearly, doing work for Votan. And Dodo is, clearly in league with them. It's a good scene, I think.
Yeah, but just as the Doctor's about to follow her over there, Ben and Polly come back with a taxi. And then you get this quite amusing scene with this old tramp that gets out of the taxi and... he's kind of really over-egging his part, isn't he?
Do you think?
It could probably just have been a non-speaking part, but he's obviously after more work.
Yeah, more work in Oliver the Musical, I think.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, so he gets out of this taxi and he's trying to kind of get off without paying. And yeah, so the taxi driver's asking him to pay, but he's only got a note, hasn't he?
Well, this is brilliant, isn't it? Because how life has changed. He needs change for a quid to pay for the taxi. And if a taxi ride costs less than a quid now, that would be about a yard, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you wouldn't get to the end of the street. And anyway, he's kind of saying, I'll just go up to the shop and change it or something. But he's had, the taxi driver's having none of it. Polly comes to his assistance and gives him some change, and the taxi driver's satisfied. The Doctor, Polly and Dodo get into the taxi, but Ben stays behind. He says his barracks must be nearby, I think. So he sort of waves them off. But just before he goes, Polly offers to stand him lunch tomorrow. And then the taxi leaves, leaving Ben and this sort of tramp fella.
Just before Ben parts company with the tramp, he asks him whether he's got a bed for the night, and this actor makes the most of telling him about this empty warehouse he's going to sleep in. It's like blooming paradise compared to where he has been sleeping recently. He then kind of hints that he wants some money off Ben, but Ben refuses and turns on his heel and walks off basically down to this services club where he's going to keep for the night. Mm. But at this point, the fellow we saw with the chloroform earlier makes a call via a old-fashioned public call box to his masters about failing to get the Doctor. And then he wanders into this empty warehouse. And there's an abrupt change to film, isn't there, as this next scene is shot in the Ealing Studios rather than the usual Lime Grove Studios.
I'm a bit confused about who he was calling the man, because he goes into the warehouse and Brett's in there, isn't he?
Well, he is.
Yeah.
Maybe he's calling Clinton or somebody back at the post office tower, but it would probably just as quick just to walk
in and tell
to Brett and tell him.
Yeah, and there's something strange with the timings about all of this as well, because it all seems to be kicking off really, really quickly. Either that or they've been in the inferno for like 24 hours or something. Because, you know, suddenly Brett's there, they've managed to set up this huge operation in this warehouse, but only kind of a couple of scenes ago they were just talking about doing it.
Yeah, and there's lots of crates and stuff, aren't there, with the Votan W printed on them.
Mm.
It looks like the whole operation's been in gestation for at least a month, doesn't it, rather than, you know, a few hours.
It does. Yeah, it's a bit problematic when it comes to the timing of it, but nevertheless, that's where we are.
We then see Professor Brett in the warehouse. He's handing out blueprints for some machinery that we later find out are going to become the war machines. And there's a bunch of sort of labourers there that are doing the construction of these machines. And there's some stock footage of some welders on there, which are getting to work on this machinery. The tramp enters this warehouse while Professor Brett is issuing orders about building and arming these machines ready for Votan to program them. And an alarm comes from a nearby piece of machinery because the tramp has been detected. And Brett orders these labourers to find and destroy him.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's able to actually locate exactly where he is and give coordinates to where he is, isn't he?
Mm.
And he says he must be destroyed. He's a danger to them. And the men start kind of running towards where Brett's said this tramp is. And he kind of tries to back away and go out, but a man on a forklift truck type thing stops him, doesn't he?
This is hilarious, isn't this scene? Because, for one thing, the tramp has heard all this, hasn't he? And
yeah.
He doesn't look particularly perturbed by it, does he?
No.
So he turns on his heel and is about to leave. And this really bored-looking bloke driving this sort of electric tug thing, isn't it? Turns up and sort of gets in his way, doesn't he? I mean, he can clearly walk past him.
Yeah.
But he doesn't. He stares at it. And this bloke's pulling this ridiculous expression. It turns out that the person driving this little electric tug is a BBC warehouse employee and not an actor. And it is extremely obvious that that's the case. He looks sort of both bored and sheepish when he gets in the way of this tramp.
Yeah, anyway, the rest of the men have surrounded him. And they basically just stand there looking at him, and he makes a run for it, and then they chase after him in a very camp manner. And it's just like, it's almost like a Benny Hill scene. They're all just kind of like running very slowly after him. And and then he stops again, and they surround him again and just stand and look at him. And then eventually he looks down at Brett. Brett's sort of down below him, isn't he? And he sees this strange bit of machinery and suddenly thinks they're all mad and, you know, what are they up to? And he makes a run for it again. And this time, you know, the group of men run after him and then you hear a scream.
Mm.
And Brett kind of smiles to himself and says, that's good, you know, everybody back to work.
Yeah. But there's a little point about this crowd of slightly strange labourers. One of them is the infamous Mike Reed, an actor from long-running British soap EastEnders. He of the terrible voice, Mike Reed.
I wonder where we're going to hear you, Jimmy Savile.
At last, I pulled it out the bag. And another point is that on the first day of filming, Mike Yarwood, 1970s popular impressionist, not painter, but used to do impressions of politicians and such like, he turned up the first day of filming, went off for an X-ray appointment and never came back.
Really?
So, yeah, two future stars were in these studios or Ealing or wherever this bit was filmed.
Mm.
So there you go. Amazing. Another factoid.
You're full of them today, aren't you?
I'm full of something.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, as I say, we get a first glimpse of a war machine, and then swiftly we're on to the doctor, who's reading a morning paper, where there's a story about the tramp being found dead in Covent Garden. How they managed to report that so quickly, I've got no idea.
I think the report actually says that his body was found at 3 a.m. Mm. I mean, I think most papers are put to bed before that, particularly in the 60s. Yeah, I mean, nowadays, the leading time's a bit shorter, but in the 60s, their paper would have been printed a long time ago, or at least finished. So, yeah, odd. And also the picture of him is a bit strange. It's a picture of him alive. So where did they get that from?
Yeah, maybe he was a big celebrity that had fallen on hard times or something.
It's probably one of the carry-on team.
But yeah, why they would be reporting the death of an old tramp in the papers anyway, that doesn't quite really make sense either.
No, particularly as it turns out that Ben read the same paper in that morning where he had quite a lot on his plate at the time.
Anyway, another timing issue there. So the doctor's talking to Sir Charles about it, and he says that he saw him last night when they were getting a taxi. And he thinks that something's up. So Charles then shows the doctor two letters that he's received, which are resignations from two top scientists, two of the best men in England, apparently. And they've disappeared under mysterious circumstances that, you know, they haven't given any reason why they've resigned. And then the doctor says, Sir Charles, I don't suppose you... No, I don't suppose you would. You have to give, I don't know what the actor's name is, but you have to give him credit because he doesn't bat an eyelid. But I can't believe that could have been scripted.
Well, no, it clearly is. But basically, the actor playing Sir Charles just says, coffee?
Yeah, to cover up.
Hartnell mumbles some sort of negative response.
Yeah, he probably fluffs that. He can't even say yes or no to that without fluffing it.
That is hilarious. That may be the biggest cock-up that Hartnell does.
Oh, no, I've got plenty more.
I mean, it certainly stands out.
Yeah. That's the most nonsensical one.
At this point, Polly enters Sir Charles's place wearing a crap hat. A terrible 60s hat. And she apologises for being late, but says she's ready to start work for Sir Charles under instruction from Major Green to fill in for Sir Charles's secretary, who's off sick.
Mm.
Sir Charles is a bit surprised by this because there's no real way that Major Green would know that his secretary was absent that day.
Right.
But he accepts Polly's assistance and then the actor manages to cock up making the coffee. He's right up close to the camera while some stuff's going in the background and he drops something or clangs something quite badly and then grins sheepishly off. So worth looking out for that when you have a look at it again.
Yeah. I think this is another kind of plot issue, really, because they're kind of raising suspicion when they don't need to, you know.
Mm.
Why would they sort of send Polly there to work for Charles when, you know, why don't they just take her over to control her? It just seems a bit of a strange thing to do.
They do a few things that really blow that, or are close to blowing their cover, don't they? It's not a very well organised thing. I don't think Votan's as clever as he thinks he is.
No. So Dodo suddenly arrives and comes in and is immediately very rude to Polly, isn't she? She
says, "Yeah, oh, cold at the very least." Yeah.
Polly sort of says, "Oh, you know, how are you doing?" And she says, "Shouldn't you be doing some work?" So Polly kind of says, "Oh, thanks very much," and just sort of disappears. So Charles mentions computers, doesn't he, to the doctor? And Dodo sort of pipes up, "Oh, you know, if you want to find out about computers, why don't you go and talk to Professor Brett?" The doctor thinks that's quite a good idea, but he says, "Oh, well, you know, a better phone ahead," which Dodo obviously thinks is a really good idea because, you know, they're going to put him straight through to Votan. So he picks up the phone and calls. It's actually quite funny when he picks up the phone. He goes through to the operator and he says, "Oh, could you put me through to Professor Brett?" And then realizes that isn't enough for an operator. So he's like, "Oh, yeah, yes, he's at the post office tower or something." Anyway, this operator puts him through. Brett actually answers, says, "Hold on a minute," and sort of says to Crimpton, at this point he says it's the doctor, doesn't he? The first time that he refers to him as the doctor, as opposed to Doctor Who.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
And Crimpton wires it up to Votan. And then at the other end of the phone, you see the doctor suddenly kind of cry out and drop the phone and grab his head. And he, you know, he falls back into a chair. So Charles and Polly sort of go off to get him a glass of water or something, while Dodo pops down next to him, sort of crouches down and sort of starts telling him Votan's plan, because she thinks that he's now been taken over. But the doctor's quite disorientated, isn't really aware of what she's saying to him, but she keeps going. And then she realises that he hasn't been converted, and she's quite distraught. And she kind of gives the game away, really, doesn't she?
But there's some extraordinary overacting from Hartnell.
There is, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, he leaps off his chair, doesn't he? And starts declaiming like some sort of Victorian Shakespearean actor, doesn't he?
Yeah.
About some terrible force that was trying to get a hold of him.
He said there was an explosion that nearly knocked him off his feet. And as if there was something enormous was trying to absorb me.
I don't remember Hartnell doing anything that sort of broad throughout the rest of his tenure. It really took me by surprise.
It's really, really unexpected. Very funny. But yeah, Dodo's sort of saying things like, "Oh, so you haven't been taken over then. So they didn't manage to convert you," or worse to that effect.
Yeah, I mean, she got the idea that Ed had been converted. She wouldn't keep talking about it.
And eventually Hartnell, because he's still quite shaken up, but eventually he cottons on to what she's saying, doesn't he? Polly and Sir Charles come back in, don't they? And they bring the doctor a glass of water. And Dodo at this point makes to leave the room, but the doctor tells her to stay. He's actually quite commanding here, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know, she stops and sort of stands still with her back to them, doesn't she? He calls her back over, and he kind of looks into her eyes, and he realises that she's been hypnotised. So he sits her down in a chair, and he points a lamp in her face, doesn't he?
Yeah, for the SS questioning routine.
And you get a fairly ridiculous scene, really, I think, but he gets a repeat after him. "My name is Dodo Chaplet. I resist all attempts to change me into somebody else."
Yeah,
it's a bit lame, I think.
Well, you wonder if that was scripted or whether Hartnell was on a frolic of his own there at that point.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that he also waves his ring at her, so to speak. And most of the stuff with the first Doctor's ring is stuff that Hartnell has added to the scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
He does, I think, treat the Doctor character as more magical than he should be.
Mm-hmm.
He should be more hard science, I think, than Hartnell does. But, you know, successive directors just let him go on with it, don't they? Yeah. He uses it in the
Web Planet.
Planet.
Yeah.
doesn't he? Yeah, and in various other places, and it just, it's a little bit like the Sonic Screwdriver before its time, isn't it? The way this sort of Ruby Ring does, you know, many different things when the plot demands it.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I think what you're trying to say is we should see less of the Doctor's ring.
Yeah, I think it'll be best all round.
The Doctor tries to break Dodo's hypnotism by waving his ring in front of her face 5 times. And on the 5th wave, Dodo falls asleep. And the Doctor thinks that she's going to sleep for 48 hours. As you say, it's some more Time Lord magic. So Charles says that he'll send her to his wife in the country so that she can recuperate.
And Hartnell comes in with another fluff where he clearly forgets his line and just says, "Yes, it's a very fine thing."
Does it? I missed that one.
Yeah. And then says, "Oh, she'll be all right after that." But, off script again, I think.
Probably on script, but just a different part of the script. It's something with the savages or something, isn't it? Anyway, that is the last that we'll see of Dodo in the series. That basically is it for Dodo, and we're only, you know, we're not even at the end of episode 2. Very strange ending.
Yeah, it is. It's to do with contracts, isn't it? Well, the production team that created Dodo left Doctor Who, basically. And with that, you know, the character, which wasn't working out that well, they thought, kind of went with them. So her contract basically is up halfway through the War Machine, so she's not allowed to be in the next 2 episodes, which is, whatever you might think of Dodo Chaplet's character, is, you know, pretty shabby, both in fictional terms and for Jackie Lane, the actress. Mm. So that's a little bit unfortunate, I think.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, really, but that's how it is. The next thing we see is a plane coming into land at an airport, and more of these Votan crates being unloaded. We get various sort of stock footage shots, and then there's Battersea Power Station, where we see more crates being unloaded there.
I think this is done quite well, isn't it? Because, as you said, it's a fair amount of stock footage, but they've just got enough scenes intercut with the W Votan boxes in there to make it feel like it's a kind of seamless movement from sort of plane to warehouse, isn't it?
Yeah. Back at the warehouse, we see an almost finished war machine being kind of pulled into position by these workmen. Major Green arrives and he orders that destructive weapons be fitted and tested. And he tests one of these weapons on one of the workmen. He just sort of points to one of them and says, you know, stand still. And then gets the war machine to shoot him.
That's quite shocking, isn't it, I think?
It is, because nobody bats an eyelid, not even the man that's about to be shot.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly controlled, isn't he? But it sort of makes it worse in a way, isn't it? Because he just stands there and waits for it to happen. Sadly, the effect doesn't really work, does it? Because the actual war machine fires out some dry ice, doesn't it? Mm. It actually misses him completely, but he sort of dutifully dies anyway.
Yeah. Back at the post office tower, Votan is asking for Doctor Who again, and Brett and Crimpton have a discussion. They suppose that Dodo must have failed, because obviously, you know, he'd be there by now. Votan says that other means must be employed to get him there. Polly suddenly arrives in the room, doesn't she? And Brett and Crimpton face her and must be kind of menacing her, because she kind of grimaces. And the scene changes. I'm not quite sure why she went there. Was there anything in the previous scene with her in where she said she was going to the tower?
Well, maybe we're heading for lunchtime when she's going to have a lunch date with Ben.
Yes, that's right.
Maybe she's dropping in the office first, but because at this point she should be working for Sir Charles, shouldn't she?
Yeah, but yeah, you're right, because the very next scene is Ben arriving at Sir Charles' place. And he's telling the Doctor that Polly's gone missing, because, you know, he's supposed to meet her for lunch and she never turned up. He tells Ben about Dodo, you know, and what's happened with her. And then they talk about the tramp that's been in the paper. And the Doctor suggests that Ben go and investigate the warehouse nearby, because sort of Ben says, oh, you know, he was going to go and sleep in this warehouse. So, he's, you know, Doctor says, you know, can you go and have a look around, but just be careful because it might be dangerous. So we see Ben walking through Covent Garden, past the Inferno nightclub, and he eventually arrives at the warehouse. Quite like that, scenes of him walking through London.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's nice to see those kind of contemporary London scenes. As we said, you know, we're quite starved at this point, but of course, in the Russell T. Davis era, you could do with rather less contemporary London scenes, but at this point, it's good.
Yeah. He walks past the Inferno Club, and he arrives at the warehouse, and they've left the door open. Because he kind of, he's outside, and you can hear what's going on inside. A bit strange.
Everything they do is carefully planned.
So he goes in, and they're continuing with these tests on the machine, aren't they?
Yeah, this war machine rather impressively destroys a table with its... it's got a couple of sort of mallet arms on either side. And then, more importantly, for its invasion technique, it manages to knock over some crates. Which, yeah, once you've got that sorted, you know, it's plain sailing, I think, for world domination.
It seems to be its forte, doesn't it, knocking over crates?
Yeah, yeah, handy. But there's a massive continuity error here, isn't there?
Yes.
This war machine is, depending on what shot you get of it, either numbered 9 or number 3. Each war machine has a number on the front and sides, and I can't remember which way around it is, but the Ealing studios, they used number 9 or number 3, I can't remember which, and the Lime Grove studio, they used the other way around. So depending on which bit was shot where, this single war machine has a different number. And it's really distracting when you watch it. I was very confused because I thought there were two war machines and they appeared to be doing the same thing. And yeah, it just doesn't work at all. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's a bit disappointing. Yeah, it kind of moves around, knocking over crates and smashing things up. And eventually it kind of bears down on Ben, who's been hiding, watching what's been going on. And he kind of comes out from behind some more crates as the machine moves towards him, shining its lights on him, and that's the end of the episode. What do you actually think of the machines themselves?
Well, they're not desperately impressive, are they? And it really, to me, just it smacks of another merchandising opportunity. I know a lot of people complain about current Doctor Who for that kind of thing. Throughout the 60s, I think they gave up after a while, there seemed to be a number of different robotic or machine-like creatures that were trying to rival the Daleks, I think, in the eyes of the people who were inventing them. And none of them, of course, ever did. And the war machines are just too boxy and too clumsy and lumbering and essentially unthreatening, aren't they? And without any of the character of the Daleks as well. They don't have that, you know, the indefinable magic that the Dalek design has. I mean, they're okay. They're a bit like tanks, which is probably what they would be like. But they're not very nimble, are they? They don't look like they'd be that difficult to overcome.
No, I mean, I think they're okay. I think, like you say, they're kind of tank-like. I think they try too hard to try and show how strong they are, and, you know, by knocking over these boxes and smashing things up and stuff, but it doesn't really work because they're not really very effective because of the prop itself, not because of the idea, I think.
Absolutely, yes. It's a realisation of the idea that's...
Yeah.
And it is quite different to the scripted idea, isn't it? They're supposed to be a lot more humanoid than what eventually turned up, which is, you know, basically some washing machines with armaments wandering around.
Yeah, you kind of got, like, on the front of them, there's these two kind of almost like egg whisk things, isn't there, that are their guns, a bit like the Dalek guns, I guess.
Well, they're very like the Dalek guns in the films, aren't they, because they fire the dry ice, don't they?
Exactly. And then there's two big kind of hammer arms you've mentioned. And then you got these, you know, like five lights at the front. And this kind of water wheel thing at the bottom, isn't there? I'm not really quite sure what that's for, but yeah, they are just a bit cumbersome, a bit blocky, aren't they, and not terribly exciting. But I think they're okay. But unfortunately, they're not used particularly well, because all they do is knock over crates.
Yeah, that's a problem. And in fact, you know, I think less is more with these. If you hadn't seen them attempting to smash up a table or knock over some crates, and just saw them killing people, that may have been a better way of doing it.
Mm. Anyway, we get the recap, where Ben's like, hiding behind the box and the machine bears down on him. But Major Green comes over to the machine, and Ben manages to get away, doesn't he? He makes his way over to the door. Major Green warns of a stranger who must be found and eliminated. You know, so he's obviously picked up the fact that Ben's around, but he hasn't actually seen where he is yet. And at this point, as opposed to before, when he's able to give him, you know, exact coordinates as to where he is, he doesn't seem to be able to do that this time.
Hmm.
Being inconsistent.
Well, maybe the tramp's so smelly that it's easy to locate.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, Polly arrives, doesn't she? She's obviously brainwashed.
Mm.
Obviously taken over by Votan. She comes in as Ben's trying to escape. Ben is like, obviously really pleased to see her, and he's telling her what he's seen inside. But Polly's not showing any emotion. As I said, she's clearly been taken over. And she kind of stands and waits as the men approach. Ben's desperately trying to get out. Well, he's trying to convince her to go with him. And then she locks the door, doesn't she? And he's kind of grappling with her, and she calls for help. And eventually the men come in and capture Ben. And he's brought in to be dealt with by the machine.
Mm, yeah.
I think Ben's very good in that scene, actually. I think it's very realistically done. You know, he's sort of frantic. He's obviously keen to get Polly out of there. He's scared about what he's seen. He's just desperate to get out of the room. I think he's a good character.
Yeah, he is. And I think Michael Craze does a very good job.
Mm.
With him as well, yeah. It's good stuff. Yeah, he's a good fella. Back at Sir Charles's office, the doctor's getting a bit worried about Ben. He obviously sent him off on this mission and hasn't heard anything back. Sir Charles says to the doctor that, you know, these rumours of something going on there shouldn't postpone C-Day, and they should maybe get the police to look into what's going on. The doctor fears that it's probably too big a job for the police, and if they get involved, he might try the threat further underground, in amongst a bit of a fluff line from Arnold.
Yeah. Major Green, you know, back at the warehouse, Major Green is saying that Ben is going to have to be destroyed, but Polly intervenes. She sort of comes forward and says, it's too early to destroy him. We need all the labour we can get. You know, we should make him work. Major Green sort of questions this, and she says, oh, you know, this is the orders of Brett and Votan. So she manages to convince him that they should keep Ben alive. Mm. So he orders them all back to work. You know, and Ben's sort of thanking her for it. And she just sort of says, blanks him and says, you know, I'm here for the victory of the war machines.
Yeah, Ben thought she was doing an elaborate ploy that she wasn't actually controlled, but pretending she was. Yeah, if it soon finds out that isn't the case. Major Green makes that wonderful remark about the mechanised evolution, doesn't he?
Mm.
Which is good sci-fi stuff.
Excellent.
Yes, it is. But one thing that you do wonder about is there's no attempt to exert Votan's control on Ben, is there?
Yeah, that's true. They could easily do it, I suppose, well, just by phoning Votan and doing it, couldn't they?
Mm.
So, yeah, probably another kind of bit of a plot inconsistency.
Yeah, it's a ploy to let him be this kind of loose cannon running around, isn't it? But, I mean, I don't think they would let that happen, would they?
No. Back in the PO Tower, Crimpton and Brett are updating the audience on Votan's plans.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
Professor Plot and Professor Exposition are telling the audience what's going on.
Exactly. They're going to take over all human authority. Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, it's quite funny they stop what they're doing and just stand and talk to camera. You mentioned it, didn't you, at the start? And just state what Votan is going to do.
to a grateful audience.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the war machine in the warehouse has almost completed its tests, and the labourers are preparing some armaments for all of the war machines. But they appear to be getting tired. One of them has the audacity to stop and wipe his brow.
Mm.
And his karate chop by Major Green.
He says, all human beings that break down will be eliminated. And then one of them stops and wipes his brow. And then he just chops him in the neck.
And then he gets sort of rolled away, doesn't he, by a war machine.
Yeah, it's great.
A trifle harsh.
Sorry.
I take it there's no such thing as a tea break.
Certainly not. What are you talking about? Yeah, Polly's looking very tired as well, and Ben's quite concerned about her, isn't he? And but she's still under the voter's control, and so she carries on regardless. She tells him that the war machines will take over at noon tomorrow. But Ben's noticed that the guard has been taken away from the door. So he creeps away, and he manages to kind of avoid everybody. Just as about to run out, Polly sees him, kind of looks at him in a very strange manner, but then just sort of carries on with what she's doing, so she doesn't raise the alarm. And he manages to get out, doesn't he?
Back at Sir Charles's place, the doctor's getting ready to go and have a look for Ben. But Ben actually stumbles in at that point and reports that Polly is in the warehouse and being controlled by something. And he also remarks that there's a killer machine out there that could, you know, cause havoc all around London.
Mm. Major Green, meanwhile, is questioning Polly as to where Ben is because, you know, she was left in charge of him. She tells him that Ben has escaped, and then she admits that she saw him but didn't raise the alarm. Green obviously questions her about this, and she's very confused, especially when Green sort of mentions friend, which confuses her even more. And he sends her back to Votan to be punished, basically, doesn't he?
Mm. Woo! Back at Charles's place, Sir Charles is refusing to believe what Ben's been saying that's going on in the warehouse with the war machines and stuff. But and Ben's really anxious to get on and take action against him. But
yeah, Sir Charles says the police can deal with it, but Ben says the machine, they send the police in, the machine will just kill him. So Sir Charles says that, you know, if the police can't handle it, then they'll call in the army. Meanwhile, the doctor says they need to strike at Votan, but Sir Charles disagrees. He says he'll handle things in his own way. And he goes off to call the minister to tell him about the war machine. The phone call to the minister is quite amusing because Sir Charles is very kind of matter-of-fact on the phone. He's talking about these very strange events in a very matter-of-fact manner, isn't he?
Yeah, it's a good old British stiff upper lip, isn't it?
Yeah.
Interestingly, this scene was apparently written on the hoof because the episode was underrunning a bit, so this was written very quickly and performed with very little notice. But you wouldn't really tell. It's quite a nice little scene.
Anyway, the minister basically says that they'll call in the army, and that's what we get, isn't it?
Yeah, sure enough, the army turn up at the warehouse. It's several truckloads, by the looks of it. They find a lot of electrical activity coming from the warehouse, and they surround it. The commanding officer here is played by John Rolfe, who later appears as Sam in the Moon Base and Fell in the Green Death. So he's something of a who stalwart.
Mm-hmm.
He sends some of his men, the Orange Patrol, into the factory, basically on a reconnoitre to see what the heck is going on.
Mm. Yeah, so they get there and they go inside. Major Green is experiencing some interference on his equipment inside. The soldiers kind of come in and they take up positions, move into the warehouse. And Green obviously realises they're there and he issues a warning that there's intruders around. And he sets the war machine to attack, which it does. And funnily enough, it kind of knocks over some crates.
Oh, does it? I think I missed that bit.
Obviously, the men had the controlled men had stacked them back up again from when they'd been knocked over before.
Well, I mean, they run out of things to do.
Yeah, I think so. And the soldiers try to start opening fire on it, don't they? But their guns all start to jam, so they don't actually fire a single shot. But the machine does start firing at them. And it all gets a bit confused here, I think. The picture quality isn't great. You know, the smoke from the war machine's gun, sort of the dry ice, obscures a lot of what you can see, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's typical. I mean, clearly that is some sort of deadly killing device, isn't it? But people are kind of just walking through these wafts of it, aren't they? I mean, it clearly isn't a poisonous gas, so, I mean, walking into it isn't going to kill them, but, I mean, it's clearly some sort of projectile weapon that kills people. I think part of the issue here is that quite a lot of this was missing, and they're patching together this scene. I think about a minute's worth is missing. They keep the soundtrack going, which of course I've got all the soundtracks, so they keep the soundtrack going, and they're just patching images in to try and fit in with it. And I think, you know, as broadcast, it's probably more successful than how we're seeing it.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. So they're being shot at by the machine. Their guns are all jamming. They have a bit of a tussle with some of the controlled workmen as well, don't they? I think there's only about one of the soldiers is actually killed, as far as I could see. One of them clearly gets killed by the machine.
Yeah, that's quite a good scene, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Very reminiscent of the Cushing films, isn't it, where the Dalek kills them.
Yeah,
it works well, I think.
And the corporal orders retreat, doesn't he? And they all sort of start making for the exit. Outside, the doctor arrives to meet Sir Charles and the minister, who with some of the other army people. And the machine follows the soldiers outside. They are all outside. It breaks through the wall of the warehouse and follows them down the this kind of cordoned off street, doesn't it?
Mm.
Knocking over some crates. It does actually fire at a kind of a cart that's got some crates on it, which bursts into flame. So that's a bit different.
That's new, yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of barges through. Again, the soldiers are trying to shoot back at it, but not managing to fire. Clearly the machine is managing to have some effect on their weapons to stop them from working. So Charles uses a loud hailer, doesn't he, at this point, and calls out to the people in the warehouse to tell them that they're surrounded. And if they don't come out, they'll open fire again. But they haven't even fired a shot.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a bit of an empty threat, isn't it?
Yeah, they even throw some grenades, and they don't even go off, do they?
Yeah, interestingly though, some of these, as you say, there's some these crates are on fire, aren't they, this time? And the chap inside the war machine, you know, the operator, if you look carefully, you can see the back of the war machine opening and some doors flapping open. That's because apparently the war machine went over some of this burning debris, and the chap inside got a little bit too warm and had to nip out the back.
He had to open his back flap to get out, did he?
He did, yeah. Yeah, well, when I get scared, certainly my back flaps open quite convincingly.
Anyway, the end of the episode is rapidly approaching. The machine continues forward, and the soldiers kind of back away, don't they? And I think Sir Charles orders tells them to retreat. They all kind of fall back. But the doctor starts stepping forward, doesn't he? Towards the machine. He walks very slowly forward directly towards it, and that kind of holds his head up, his chin up in a defiant manner.
Mm.
And that is the end of the episode.
Yeah, you see the light from the war machine's eye sort of playing upon his face, don't you?
Yeah.
So it ends, yeah.
I think it's quite a good ending.
Yeah, it is. It
doesn't make any sense, but it's a good ending. Because it's just pure chance that the machine, you know, as we find out very shortly, it's just pure chance that the machine stops working at that point, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it is a feeble resolution, isn't it? Because the doctor can't have known that, can he?
No, he can't have known that. He may have had an idea that it hadn't been properly programmed, but he certainly wouldn't have known that it would stop at that precise point.
Mm. And he doesn't bother tell anyone else either. So Ben's desperately trying to drag him to safety, isn't he?
Mm.
He's standing around. He does a sort of stupid dance, doesn't he, in front of this war machine as it grinds through a hole. And then eventually the radar dish stops moving, and it's kind of, you know, dormant at that point.
Yeah. I'd written down here in my notes, you know, what on earth was he doing? It doesn't make any sense why he would do that.
No, it makes a good cliffhanger, but yeah, it makes a pathetic resolution to a cliffhanger. It's,
yeah.
Moving on to the pub, which is a good idea at this point, I think. The familiar face of Kenneth Kendall, who was a TV newsreader for several decades, I think, wasn't he?
Mm.
He's actually used in person to deliver these news reports for this story. And he says to the assembled watchers that the war machine has been stopped, but further attacks can be expected over the next day or so.
Mm.
But that's an idea that we use quite regularly, haven't they? And particularly recently in Doctor Who, they've used real life newsreaders, haven't they, to deliver fictional news.
Yeah, that would have been the first use of that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it probably would be. And in fact, the later on we hear some radio reports, and that, I've forgotten the chap's name, but he was a famous or recognisable voice, at least, on the radio, in terms of news reading, and they got him on board for that as well. So that must have been had quite a lot of impact in the day, I think.
The Doctor is meeting with the Minister, and he says that the computer wasn't completely programmed, as alluded to earlier, which is why the machine stopped. So Charles says that they attacked the warehouse just in time before the machine was fully ready, but now they have to locate the other machines. And we cut to a man who's calling central control from Sector 2 to report that they've completed their war machine. I think Brett orders him to basically activate it.
The Doctor's investigating the sort of out-of-action war machine when Ben turns up. Having been unable to find Polly. The Doctor complains of being hot, and he hands his cloak to Ben. And as he does so, a TARDIS key falls from the pocket, and Ben goes down and picks it up. But he's going to hand it back to the Doctor, but the Minister of Defence comes over to him and asks the Doctor for a status report. And the Doctor has worked out from examining the war machine that there are 11 more units in a kind of 20 to 30 mile radius around London, and also that they're all set to begin an attack at noon. So he's done quite a decent software interrogation there, I think.
This is so unconvincing for two reasons. The Doctor's delivery is dreadful, and it's just like, how can he tell that from just looking at some circuitry?
Well, that's I think the key to the problem there is your first point, isn't it? You have to deliver this stuff with conviction.
Yeah, and he doesn't.
You're going to convince anybody that you know what you're talking about, and you know, Hartnell fails badly. It takes you out of the drama each time. Do you think Hartnell's struggling for the next word? Yeah, unfortunately, that makes him a very unwatchable Doctor.
Yeah. Anyway, meanwhile, another war machine is being tested, isn't it? And Brett seems to be given the orders, but he doesn't appear to be there. He seems to be doing it via a radio that's on a bench. It's a bit strange, this bit, because the machine comes forward and smashes with its big hammer arm and destroys this radio. So Brett's instructions obviously are no longer getting through, and they've lost contact with it. And it also kills the man that's been testing it as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's strange because, I mean, it's gone rogue, hasn't it? It seems.
Yeah.
But Brett is controlled by Votan, so his instructions are coming from Votan. You would think this machine was controlled by Votan, but so it seems to not be listening to Votan anymore.
It just seems to be going off on a bender, basically.
Yeah, he wouldn't be doing these things otherwise. I mean, interestingly, at this point, there's a kind of horizontal grill at the front of the war machine, and if you look not even particularly carefully,
yeah,
you can see the face of the chap inside, Gerald Taylor, who moves towards a little bit too close to the mesh.
He does. Have a look outside and see what's going on.
at one point, I think he picks his arm out and tries to get William Hartnell's autograph. I think I guess that's
it. No, he wasn't trying to get his autograph, he was showing him his lines. Anyway, the army captain is telling the Minister and Sir Charles that the brainwashed men have been rounded up, and they bring in Major Green, who's he's very confused, isn't he? He says he can't remember anything.
There's a cracking bit here, actually. As Major Green passes the Doctor, the Doctor's got hunched underneath sort of an overhanging part of the war machine, and he kind of clocks that it's Major Green walking past, and he gets up to follow him, and he cracks his head on the
and then from then on his lines are all delivered perfectly.
And he lived to 108.
Anyway, Major Green's very confused, he can't remember a thing. The Doctor says that he's going to need medical attention. They discuss whether or not he's been telling the truth. The Doctor's convinced that he is, and he complains to Charles about his strong arm methods, doesn't he?
He gets quite heavy on his ass, doesn't it, at this point?
Yeah. And then we get a shot of a man who's calling the police to report that he's seen another war machine in the streets. And he's calling from a phone box, isn't he? And he says that it's seen him, and you see the machine approach the phone box and shoot him, you know, while he's still inside.
Then you hear over the radio there's a warning going out to the citizens of London to stay off the streets and not attempt to confront the machines. The next scene is some people listening to the same radio report standing in front of a back projection of a living room.
Oh, well.
Which is horribly unconvincing.
Never mind. Ben is still worried about Polly, isn't he? And he's talking to the doctor. The doctor's saying he's too busy to worry about just one person. The war machine continues to cause havoc out in the streets. So Charles gets a call that it's heading towards Battersea Power Station. So, you know, the doctor thinks, oh, you know, this is our chance. It's our chance to get it. And he says something like, our only one chance is to paralyze the nervous system of that mechanism.
Hey!
Anyway, they decide they're going to try and capture it.
Yeah, the doctor believes it's controlled by electromagnetics, and he thinks he can do something with that if he captures one of them. Back in Professor Brett's office, Polly enters, apparently after some discipline from Votan. She voluntarily requests to be judged by Votan for allowing Ben to escape.
Mm.
And it's clear that if she's found wanting, Votan will eliminate her. But it's decided for now that she'll be judged later because assistance is needed.
The doctor, meanwhile, is asking Charles for equipment to set up a powerful electrical field. And I start to plan where they're going to set this thing up to trap it. And we hear a kind of a voice on a kind of a tannoy telling people to stay off the streets. And the army are setting up this trap for the machine.
Interestingly, the voice there is, it comes from one of those police cars with a loud hailer on the top. Mm. The voice is provided by Michael Craze, Ben himself.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the doctor and Sir Charles arrive in a car, don't they? And they go into this kind of tent where Ben's inside with some of the soldiers. And they start to sort of talk about this plan. The doctor draws on a piece of paper a square box with only three sides, and he explains that they'll get the war machine to go in, and then they'll complete the circuit behind it to square the box, kind of thing. And he says that he'll be the one to connect the cable. But Ben says something about him being a bit past it for all that kind of lark. so he says that, you know, it's something that he should do.
Yeah, the doctor's not very chuffed by that remark.
Not particularly. But does take him up on the offer.
He does, yeah. And sure enough, this sort of three-sided square is set up. And a war machine approaches kind of slightly downhill towards this thing, firing at nothing, it seems.
Yeah, it's randomly firing, isn't it?
Yeah, wasting all its resources. Ben takes up his position, you know, ready to run and connect the cable to the and complete the square once the war machine is in there. Mm. After hesitating for a bit, the war machine finally moves into the sort of trap area. Ben zips over, connects the cable, and throws the switch. The war machine isn't shut down, is it, by the kind of field, but it does allow the doctor to get close enough to get around behind it and adjust it with a screwdriver without actually looking at it, which all looks a bit strange. His arm's sort of pumping and he's pulling this strange expression. You kind of wonder exactly what he's doing as he's gazing wistfully into the distance.
But anyway, it stops its strange beeping noise that it makes. It's kind of Votan noise, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So it's effectively been switched off.
Elsewhere, there's sort of questions appear to be going around the world, or at least in a back-projected office in America, that they're wondering if the attacks are limited to London or if the whole world might be at risk from the war machines.
Mm. So, yeah, Sir Charles joins the doctor by the machine and the minister turns up as well, and the doctor tells them that he's adjusted the machine and given it a special program. And he activates it and the machine starts to move. They all kind of step back a bit and it just sort of sets off. They're all sort of saying, you know, what happens now? He says, well, it started at the tower. That's, you know, where I think it will probably end. Ben thinks that Polly's probably there because, you know, that's probably the only place she could have gone to. And he wants to go and rescue her. And the doctor's sort of saying, no, you know, don't be silly. But he runs off. much to the Doctor's dismay.
Yeah, quite overacted again, I thought, the Doctor's dismay at this point.
Yeah, a little bit, but at least he didn't fluff the line. You get this really odd shot, don't you, of the War Machine trundling through the streets of London, where they're just basically moving the background rather than, shooting it in the street, which is, you know, it's a bit unnecessary, really.
Well, it is. I mean, it's the War Machine is clearly stationary, and there's a back projection of Tottenham Court Road, isn't there?
Yeah.
After they later used exactly the same back projection for when the Doctor's in the Minister's car, and he's basically saying that everything should go as planned with the War Machine that he reprogrammed. Votan should be deactivated, and all those people who've been hypnotised by Votan should be released for their hypnosis. And there's also another scene of this War Machine on its way to the post office tower, which is horribly speeded up. Make it look rather less lumbering than it has been so far.
Yeah, it certainly puts on a speed, doesn't it? Brett and Crimpton are up in their office in the top of the tower, and they say that the War Machines are going to are getting ready to attack in 11 minutes.
Woohoo!
Very precise. But Votan says that it will give the order.
So
anyway.
The other thing is, Votan's getting a bit huffy about it giving the order, but presumably Brett and Crimpton are only following his orders anyway. So.
Yeah, and effectively they are part of Votan, you know.
Yeah, exactly, so what difference does it make?
The Doctor's in the car, as you were saying, with Sir Charles, and is explaining that, you know, when the War Machine meets Votan, it will be like two electrical currents coming together.
At this point, Ben bursts into Professor Brett's office in the tower and grabs Polly and drags her out of the room and down the hall just as his reprogrammed War Machine enters. Crimpton attempts to jump at it and try and manually shut it down, but he's killed in the process. Helpfully, he throws himself against Votan and appears to die before he's actually shot. It's a little bit unfortunate. The little blast of dry ice hits him after he's done his dramatic death flex.
Yeah.
He gets him in the end.
Yeah. And then there's lots of kind of smoke and explosions as the War Machine shoots at the Votan computer. Brett puts his hand up to his head again, clasps his head, and basically comes round from his conditioning, doesn't he? Votan's being destroyed.
Hurrah!
And he goes to examine Crimpton's body, just as the Doctor, Sir Charles, and the Minister arrive. The Doctor comes in, and he says that all the other machines have been immobilised, looking very chuffed with himself. Sir Charles talks to Brett, who says that he's okay, he doesn't know what's been happening, you know, and Sir Charles sort of says, I know somebody that can explain it all, and they turn around, but the Doctor's already disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sure enough, he's standing outside the TARDIS in mime mode again, because it's on film, on location.
Yeah. What did you think of the climax bit?
It's not bad. I mean, turning something against its creator is not a new idea, but I think it's okay.
Yeah, it seemed a little bit rushed. There's an issue about as to how the War Machine got up there.
Yeah, it looks a bit big, to use the lift, doesn't it? But it got there somehow. It's probably a little on the rushed side, but I suppose you kind of see it coming from when the Doctor reprograms it. But anyway, he's outside the TARDIS and clearly waiting for somebody, presumably Dodo. Polly and Ben appear. Polly effectively writes out Dodo from the story, telling the Doctor that she feels much better, she wants to stay in London, and she sends the Doctor her love. The Doctor nose is clearly put out of joint by this. And he kind of thanks Polly and Ben and sends them on their way and goes into the TARDIS.
Yeah, so Ben and Polly leave, and they're a bit put out by the Doctor's attitude, aren't they? They call him a grumpy old so-and-so. And then they watch him as he uses the key to go into the police box. Ben remembers he's got the Doctor's key that the Doctor dropped from his cloak earlier. So they decide to go give it back to him. So they go back to the police box and, you know, the door's locked. And they're wondering what he's doing inside. So they use the key, open the door, and go in. And the TARDIS dematerialises. And then two people walk in front of the camera, look at the audience, and then walk off. And that's the end.
Yeah, apparently not noticing some massive object in front of them has just disappeared. while they walk towards it.
It's a bit of a strange ending.
Five Doctor syndrome there.
Yeah. But yeah, the TARDIS has got, two new companions. Probably more successful ones than the last one.
Well, it certainly breaks the cycle of having sort of Susan alikes, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Vicky, Dodo, and I suppose Katerina to an extent as well. Mm. They're all just basically replacements for Susan. But you get the feeling that Polly's something quite different.
Yeah.
And Ben is something quite different to Stephen and Ian as well, isn't he? So it feels fresh. It feels kind of lively 60s,
yeah.
Doesn't it? It feels like it's already going in a new direction.
It does. Interestingly, I think this is probably one of Dodo's best stories.
Mm.
She's actually quite good at it, and she's only in half of it. From my memories of her other stories, she's pretty dreadful.
Well, my major problem with Dodo is, what is her accent supposed to be? Because she's supposed to be from London, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yet, her early story, she's got some weird Lancashire accent, isn't she?
Yeah.
And then she's basically sort of RP, isn't she, by the end? And it's just, what is going on, and why hasn't anyone spoken to the actress and told her to be consistent? Or maybe it's the fault of the directors that she's ended up with all these different accents, but...
Yeah. I don't think it's that she's a bad actress. I think she's actually quite good, but her, like you say, her accent's all over the place. And they didn't really know what they were doing with the character.
Yeah, I don't think it's that Jackie Lane's a bad actress. I think it's just something weird is going on with the accent there. I mean, I imagine she's just following instructions in each of the stories, but there's no consistency there.
No. It's an interesting one. What did you think of it as a whole?
Well, it's kind of hard to put it into context, because as we've discussed, it's the first time the Doctor Who has tackled a computer, you know, outgrowing its creators and having a mind of its own.
Mm.
That's quite a tired idea now, isn't it, for us? But, you know, back in the day, probably that was quite exciting.
Mm.
So, yeah, I guess you have to take that into account. But, I mean, the idea is good, I think. It's some issues with execution.
Yeah. I think my main issue with it is Hartnell, really.
Yeah.
He is awful in it. He fluffs every line he delivers. And I'm not over-exaggerating it, really. 90% of his lines are either fluffed or delivered poorly and unconvincingly. And it detracts because unfortunately, everybody else is pretty good in it.
Mm.
Sir Charles' Summer character is pretty good, pretty convincing. Ben and Polly... both very good characters. Even Dodo, you know, in this one is good, as we've said. I think the characters that are taken over by Votan are all pretty good.
The army are good as well. The army captain and the sergeant, they're good.
Yeah.
It's pretty good all round. And for the leading actor to be dragging it down is obviously a real shame.
Mm.
But it becomes an exercise of sort of gritting your teeth, waiting for the next fluff, isn't it? Rather than losing yourself in the story.
Hmm. That said, though, I have to say I quite enjoyed it, really. I think it's pretty watchable. The plot is a kind of a tired idea now, but I think it works well for a Doctor Who at that time. It's a pretty solid story. It's full of holes, which we've pointed out along the way, but none of it is absolutely dreadful. You know, it's all, you know, there's some issues over timing, you know, when events occurred and that kind of thing, and it's a bit of inconsistency with what's going on with Votan. You know, why doesn't he try and control some people? He just lets them go. But I think they're all fairly minor things. I think it races along at a fairly good pace.
Mm.
Not a lot of padding in there. Yeah, I think it's reasonably good. I mean, it's not fantastic, but I think it's an okay story.
Yeah, I think so. I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to from, you know, my memories of watching it on VHS and stuff. I think the key for me is I love all any kind of black and white 60s location stuff. I really like to see, and there's heaps of it in this.
Mm.
It's a nice sort of swinging 60s grooviness to it, isn't there? Which you don't see, certainly up to this point. You see a little bit more, I guess, during Troughton's reign, but it's nice to see that, and it really feels quite different to what's gone before it. And it also sets the template, doesn't it, for the whole kind of unit stuff. It really is the first contemporary army against, oddly, it's not an alien menace, is it, this time?
No.
It's a kind of a homegrown problem, isn't it? But certainly setting, you know, army against futuristic, at least, sort of threat hasn't really happened before. And even to the point of including an expendable tramp, which it certainly gets used a lot in the Pertwee era, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's a good point about the unit thing, because it does feel like a unit story ahead of its time.
Well, you could replace Sir Charles with the Brigadier fairly comfortably, I think, couldn't you?
Yeah, you could.
The War Machines, I think, could have been better and more threatening, certainly. Dodo's exit is shabby, to say the least. Yeah. I mean, that makes Leela's exit look believable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And satisfactory. And there's a massive gaffe with the numbering of the War Machines, isn't there? And maybe the biggest gaffe of all is calling the Doctor Doctor Who throughout. Yeah, they don't destroy the story, but I think they make it, that certainly the War Machine design makes it feel a bit more workmanlike as a story than perhaps it could have been.
Mm. I think overall it's just kind of average, this story. It's not particularly bad. It's not particularly good. It's watchable.
I think it turns out to be quite influential. I mean, I imagine when it got to Pertwee's era, they must have looked back at this amongst other stories and thought, well, this kind of, you know, army against threat stuff can work. And they may have looked at this when they were thinking about the Web of Fear and the Invasion, even before all the, you know, the classic unit era. So, yeah, I think it's one of those things that, because the idea has been taken on and expanded, the original idea looks less worthy, but at the time this must have felt quite different to anything else that had been seen in the series before.
Yeah, definitely. And like you say, I mean, it is almost the template for the Pertwee years, isn't it? You know, the Doctor being in amongst the authority figures and having to deal with them, you know, a bit of a confrontation with them. You know, working with the army to defeat a threat.
There are certain scenes. The scene with the press conference for Votan it really reminds me of that scene about the Keller machine in Mind of Evil.
Yeah.
As watching that, really, really reminiscent, even so far as having the Doctor sort of standing there being sceptical. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that gets on to be used again, and we shouldn't forget this is where it all started, I suppose.
Mm.
Just a little bit on the kind of stats for this story. The audience figures for episode 1, it was 5.4 million, dropped in episode 2 to 4.7 million, back up again to 5.3 million for episode 3, and then up to a high of 5.5 million for the last episode. So fairly consistent, and some lost viewers regained, have a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
The audience reaction figures aren't so good. Episode 1 starts, you know, half decent, 49, down to 45 for episode 2, down to 44 for episode 3, and then down to a lowly 39 for the last episode. Also got some verbatim stuff from some of the people who were kind of, had their views panelled on this. A lot of people thought the War Machines were kind of poor relations to the Daleks. Some people thought the show at this point had run out of ideas and should probably be rested, which is interesting. Maybe they just thought that Hartnell should be rested. but apparently the children enjoyed it. They were especially keen on seeing a show in present-day London, apparently.
Yeah.
It made a pleasant change, which is saying it was quite different then. Back to the negatives, the audience were talking about ham acting and some quite a lot of hesitations with the acting, and I'm assuming most of that is Hartnell, although the actor playing Sir Charles, I know he's hesitated in a couple of places, but mostly I thought he was pretty good. Some people praised the actors for performing such rubbish with such conviction. And the last point I'll bring up here is a lot of people thought the sets were a bit tinny looking, and the War Machines were rubbish and could have been designed better by their children. So fairly damning, I think. But that kind of anecdotal stuff is reflected in those audience reaction figures, I think.
Mm.
My brother Rob has a few comments to make about the War Machines. Yeah, noticed that Hartnell was fluffing lines all over the place and didn't think the War Machines were much cop. He thought the hypnotized humans were a bit unimpressive too, but he says, to be fair, it must be quite a hard thing to act. And I think some people made it look harder to act than others. He says he thought the story started off well, but degenerated from episode to episode. Perhaps his expectations were a bit too high when he bought it. But so I think that's a lot, you know, it's been reflected in the audience feedback and what we've been saying. But Martin, you've got some other feedback, haven't you?
Yeah, on the Facebook page, we've got some feedback from Mike Wemban. He says, just a thought that came to me, when the doctor wants to test Votan, he just asks him what the square root of some number is and then says that's close enough. Surely even in 1966 there were adding machines and the like. Dodo then goes on to ask the machine what TARDIS means. Bit of a leap between the two questions. Yeah.
Somewhat.
Mind you, he probably makes up for it all in a 1960s regalia. Wow. I could just imagine going out with her to Club UFO in the front row watching Pink Floyd with Sid Barrett still in the lineup. Imagine that.
Happy days. Happy days.
Better than that club that she hangs out at with Ben, dressed up like one of the village people or something.
Very true. Hello, sailor.
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff, Mike. I guess we better rate the thing, haven't we?
Yeah, we had. Do you want to go first?
I'm rating it as I'm watching it rather than, you know, the kind of historical precedents it sets and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just doing it as a story. I'm giving it a 6 out of 10.
Mm.
I think it's sort of workmanlike, but with some kind of interesting bits here and there. So not completely average at 5, but a little bit above at 6.
Mm. Yeah, I think I'd have to go along with that. Like I say, it's kind of like, I said, it's okay. It's not terrible. It's not particularly good, but it's reasonably enjoyable. So yeah, 6 seems about right for me as well. So I'll go along with that.
There we go. That doesn't happen very often, does it? We get exactly the same rating.
No, not very often.
That's because mostly what you say is rubbish.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Blimey, I'm a bit wrong-footed now.
Put you off your stroke.
So, about time we had a think about what we're going to do next.
Yeah, so the next story, what we're going to do this time round is we're going to go with a choice that some friends of mine have been bugging me to cover since we actually started doing this podcast. John and Gail, who listen regularly and, you know, have been supporting us since the start, and they want us to cover The Curse of Fenric.
Ah, Sylvester McCoy.
Indeed. So we're going to go with that one for the next podcast.
Excellent.
So, yeah, that'll be good.
And after that, as the name of this podcast might imply, we will be doing Seeds of Doom, which comes out on DVD on the 25th of October this year. So we're quite excited about that. And, so after Curse of Fenric, we'll be doing Seeds of Doom.
Excellent. So, you know, everybody get out there, have a watch, and let us know what you think. And if you've got any more comments on the War Machines, let us know about that as well. And we'll do some feedback next time.
Yeah, so to all the usual places, the email address is crinoid@mail.com. The blog site is crinoid.blog.co.uk. If you pop over there and have a look at the listings on the top left-hand side, you'll find an easy access to our Facebook page. And you can also tweet us at Crinoid. So there's plenty of ways of getting your opinion across, and we hope you do.
Good stuff. That's about it for this time, isn't it?
I think it is, you know.
Okay, so let's sign off. We'll see you all again next time.
Yep, see you next time. Yeah.